Hello and welcome to the final episode of this series of the Marie Keating Foundation Talks Cancer podcast. What a journey we've been on looking at prostate cancer at every step. We're closing out this series with a powerful conversation about survivorship. What happens after treatment? How does it impact you physically and emotionally? We are privileged to be having a frank and open discussion with Jer O'Boyle. We hope this powerful and impactful discussion will inspire more open conversations amongst others facing these issues.
Hi, Jer. It's great to have you here with us today. Thanks for coming along. So we're here talking prostate cancer in our podcast, and I've known you for a long time, Jer. Lovely to have you here. And we've spent many a time together at urology conferences, so totally respect the work you do, and we'll talk more about that as we go along. So, Jer, you're a registered advanced nurse practitioner in Galway University Hospital. Tell me a little bit about the work you do.
Thank you very much for inviting me. How times have changed. We're now on podcasts. I primarily work with men that receive radiation treatment, either external beam radiotherapy or brachytherapy for prostate cancer. And within that, I also look at, I suppose, survivorship issues, symptoms or toxicities they may have after treatment. And again, then to progress that role, I do an erectile dysfunction clinic one day a week. I don't just see men then that have had radiotherapy. I also see men that have had prostate surgery.
Okay.
So I see any man. My cohort includes any man that has been diagnosed with a prostate cancer. It doesn't matter what stage of their diagnosis they're at. I can see them at any time because I suppose erectile dysfunction changes over time. So it may not be significant in the beginning, middle. So I see them when it's significant for them.
Just to shed some light on a couple of episodes we've done prior to us meeting today, we talked to John Wall, who has stage 4 prostate cancer. And we've also talked to Paul Ferris, who had stage 2 prostate cancer, but with a positive margin. So both of those gentlemen have had varied forms of treatment. But I'll come back to Paul for a minute because he's talked quite a lot about, you know, his journey with erectile dysfunction. He had a prostatectomy. He had a positive margin, and then he had to go on and have hormone therapy with radiotherapy. So it has left him, you know, in a state of, I suppose, having tried to manage this over a 6-year period, you know, and I mean, when I say this, I mean his erectile dysfunction and his shortening of the penis. But, you know, having, I suppose, tried, tested, and not necessarily failed, but he's come to a point where, you know, he uses injections and they work for him when he needs them. But of course, I suppose, let's talk about that first. I mean, there's so many things we could talk about today, but we'll talk about your role in managing the erectile dysfunction. I suppose that one of the things I'd like maybe for you to tell us about is the multidisciplinary team. Are you part of that process or...?
Well, what generally happens, I suppose, if man has had radiotherapy within the institution I work in within Galway, I would likely have met those men previously throughout their cancer journey. But to when I see a patient, I usually would receive a referral from their consultant to see the patient. And it, so it's discussed with the man that he's coming to see me about erectile dysfunction. So I suppose that's in itself, that was one of the reasons why we try to segregate the clinic so that you're coming just about sexuality and your erections. It's not about your PSA. It's not about any other symptoms. While they all may be interlinked, but that's the reason why we're coming to the clinic. So generally then the man, I send a letter to the man to contact me. And quite often it is man's partner that contacts me directly.
Okay.
However, I do try and encourage, I do try and do the first link over the phone actually, because I find that sometimes it's a little bit easier to have somewhat of an open conversation on the phone. Men can get a little bit more relaxed. Obviously, I establish that they're not in the supermarket doing their shopping while I'm talking to them and that we're all in a nice, quiet environment. And then at least they know that I'm quite approachable. I would believe that I'm quite an open person. And I think that's the main emphasis on erectile dysfunction and sexual dysfunction, is at least to open the conversation. As Paul mentioned earlier on, there can be a lot of, it's a journey and expectations may not be what you had hoped they would be when you start, but it is a journey, and it's in a journey where the first step is to talk about it and to open it and to see where people are at, where their partners are at, because a lot of the time partners are protecting one another. One, you know, doesn't want to say it to the other. And so a lot of that is missing. So the first part, when a man comes to see me, then the consultation is about an hour and a half. I generally allow an hour and a half so that we're not rushing anybody, the first consultation. And that's the first thing we discuss, is the openness of intimacy, talking to your partner. A lot of people come on their own. I do encourage them if they like to bring somebody with them.
Yeah.
But again, sometimes men find it easier to come on their own first and open it up and really express their concerns. Quite often, it's not about sexual intercourse. It is about the intimacy and what they're missing from their partner. And I suppose we should also acknowledge some men have been diagnosed with a prostate cancer diagnosis, have had treatment, and they may not yet have met their partner. So that obviously is very difficult as well. It's very hard to embark on new relationships.
And we acknowledged that in a previous episode there. Paul talked about that. And I think it is really good to acknowledge that, because it's a different space altogether, isn't it?
It really is. Yeah. It really is a different space and it's different concerns when you meet somebody. How do you bring up? Because even if we do get, or hopefully when you get to interventions that you're happy with, it is still different. It's not the same.
Yeah. And the other thing I like that you mentioned there, Jura, is, you know, around relationships. There is, of course, a strong encouragement for men to bring their partners, but it's whatever works best, isn't it, in that open conversation and to get men talking, isn't it?
Absolutely. And quite often they wouldn't bring their partner for the first consultation. But then once we go through everything and, you know, the different aspects of it, they feel more a little bit more comfortable with me possibly. And then we just make another appointment and they encourage their partner to come.
Yeah.
Because I think it is good for there to be an outsider, for want of a better word. It's quite a tense topic.
Yes.
And it's not just that people are missing the sexual intercourse part, but a lot of time people are just missing the kissing and the cuddling and watching a TV program and not avoiding one another.
Mm-hmm.
So often they come back a second time with their partner, and then, so I really let the man guide the journey.
Okay.
Rather than anything else. I think my biggest skill, hopefully, is listening to see where we're at that time.
And what you can offer as interventions. Something that's interesting, and it's cropped up as well, is kind of that fear of even, you know, considering intimacy because of the inability to perform.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really important to grasp as well, isn't it, for
absolutely,
men?
Yeah. And even the fear of trying different interventions, they may not work. So it's to try and just bring up the conversation that intimacy is so much more than intercourse. Yeah. And it's the not turning over in the bed. It's those kind of things that people miss. And we also have to acknowledge people have very busy lives. So even before you had a prostate cancer diagnosis, you had a very busy life. So you have to make time for these things, because life moves on and life is still, work is still there. Children are still there.
Yeah. So it's busy. Okay. So I suppose just thinking about our listeners now, Jura, We're talking survivorship here, and we want people to live their best quality of life and their best lives. And I suppose in all of that, it is like managing these unwanted effects that are lingering around. So take me through a journey then with a man or a person who's been born with a prostate and has prostate cancer and their partner. So tell me about the treatment options. I'm inquisitive to know. What's out there?
The treatment options can vary over time. And I think, I suppose the main focus initially is that cancer is treated and is managed, be it that it's gone or it's in remission or whatever it is. So then we discuss various interventions. There's obviously medication, and most people would like that medications would work and would be their first option, but unfortunately they're not.
Yeah.
So if somebody, for example, has had a prostate surgery and they were unable to spare nerves because they needed to do more extensive surgery, they wouldn't be able to get an erection from medication. And hormonal treatment also can interfere with man's lack of libido, interest, desire, sexual function. So for, I suppose, tablets to work, you need good nerve supply, and you also need an interest. So it's not like you can just pop the tablet and away you go and see how you get on. But depending on that, we go through whether the options are available. Now, just for I suppose it's important to acknowledge men that have had prostate surgery as their main form of treatment. they may not be able to respond to medication initially, but actually they may do after about 2 years. So it can take up to two to 3 years.
That's interesting, isn't
it? It is, and I think that's important for men to know. Yeah. I tend to, when I meet somebody, we often talk about rehabilitation and going through that process. So they will have been given medication after their surgery, but that is to enhance blood flow. They won't necessarily get an erection from it. So we discuss those things.
That's something new, isn't it? I know it hasn't been around a long, long time, but penile rehabilitation is a thing, isn't it?
Rehabilitation is a thing. It also gets you back into the concept of looking at that part of your body differently, not just as a cancer and where you had cancer in that area. It starts you getting to look at that part of your body as part of you, because men would describe to me that their penis can feel different. It can feel just the sensations are different. It doesn't feel part of them. So rehabilitation can encourage that to start feeling a little bit more like that.
Yeah, great. So you've done that with them prior to or immediately after surgery, I suppose.
When they feel ready. And that is different for every man. Yeah. You know, a diagnosis of cancer is not an easy diagnosis one way or the other. So in my experience, sexual dysfunction doesn't become the biggest issue initially. You know, there is issues with urinary incontinence and all of those things. So it's where they are priorities in life, or the difference in radiotherapy. Maybe they may be a little bit more fatigue after treatment or if they're on hormonal treatment. So it depends on where somebody
is at.
Yeah, and I think that's not a very general thing. That is just where... The important thing for listeners, I think, is you know yourself where you're at. It's never too soon to open the conversation. You may open the conversation with your health professional and meet with somebody, but then you might just hold on to that name and not do anything for a number of months. And that's fine, too.
Okay. So we've talked about the tablets or the oral treatments, and we've talked about...
The other important thing about tablets, just if they are working for people, and I think this is another thing that people just don't understand, they're better work taken on an empty stomach.
Okay.
So, and times of day may make a difference. Okay, so sometimes they work better for men in the morning.
Yeah.
So just we go through that.
Okay, good. So we'll follow on from that then, Ger, so the tablets may work, then what if they don't work?
If they don't work, there is other options. I would also discuss with men, spontaneity is a little different. So, and again, we kind of have to open it up in the room and in with them or their partner of expectations. Spontaneity is different. Mm-hmm. Interventions are different.
Yeah.
It can still be enjoyable. In fact, you can reach climax without ever getting an erection. It's about sensation and touch, but it's just that it's different.
Yeah.
So there's two kind of other options. Then there's a vacuum pump device or injection therapy.
Okay.
And again, I go through both options with the men. We demonstrate the vacuum pump devices. They do have a cost associated, so that can be an impending factor, unfortunately.
Okay.
Hopefully, maybe something that will change in the future.
Yeah. Not provided by the HSE at the moment. No. Okay.
So they do have a cost associated. So a vacuum pump can be very helpful. Can be quite helpful, actually, particularly if you're not in a relationship, because it's very hard to inject yourself if you're not going to plan on having intercourse.
Yeah.
However, a lot of men will miss not seeing an erection first thing in the morning. That's what they're used to all of their lives. Mm-hmm. Men would describe it as that they've lost a pep in their step, so that seeing the erection in the morning can help give them a bit of that pep back a little bit. They feel more like themselves. It helps with their body image.
Yeah.
It can also help with the penile length.
Okay.
But if you were going to use a vacuum pump device, you need to use it. It is a very expensive commodity. Mm-hmm. If it's a very expensive wash bag if you just leave it sitting in the press. So you do have to use it 3 to 4 times a week, not for intercourse, for exercise.
Okay.
But it can work very well for intercourse. And the other option then is injection therapy.
Okay.
And injection therapy is not as difficult as it sounds. People think it's terrible, but it's not actually. And men would generally come to me and do the first injection with me. So I teach them how to draw it up and inject.
Mm.
I suppose it is important to acknowledge when we are talking about cost factors, because in this climate, you can get 4 tablets on your medical card if you have a medical card or on the drug payment scheme. And you can also get 4 injections. You can't get the 2, but you can get 1 or other.
Yeah.
4 injections on your medical card are... the drug payment scheme.
Okay.
There's obviously side effects with the injections, and I go through that with men. But most men, if you know, once they're taught properly, The most thing that will turn some men off using it, it can be a little bit uncomfortable, but usually I go through with them about taking painkillers before it.
So there's plenty of options there, it sounds like.
There is. And there's also, in the long term, if somebody was interested, they can see a specialist surgeon about a penile implant.
Okay.
But it is important to, again, acknowledge that where it's at one point may not necessarily be where it's at later on.
And do you see, I suppose, a lot of success in the work that you do? And by that, I don't necessarily mean that you see men and they're really happy because they can get an erection, but that they have kind of found their own space and place and peace of mind.
I'd like to think so, hopefully. And I suppose it's hard to measure success, and it's me that's doing a clinic. So, you know, I wouldn't like to be pressurizing anyone to say that I'm lovely or I'm very good. But I do continue virtual clinics with a man until he ultimately, you know, feels that he's fine. And then they have my direct contact details.
Yeah.
So a good 50 to 60%, 70% of the time, men may not end up with erections for sexual intercourse, but are happier with their intimate relationship or with where their lives are at.
Okay.
And I suppose on the other side of it, the clinic is getting busier. So I'm getting referrals for men, which I find very reassuring, from men that have spoken to their friends about it, that, you know, from support groups, they've said, oh, well, I met Jer.
Yeah.
You should go to Jer, ask your consultant to, you know, so I have got referrals. So I think that's always a good indicator to me that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, word of mouth is a good thing, I think.
Yeah, no, and it's a fantastic service, you know, for men to have, or for families to have even. But I suppose my next question to you would be, is this a service that's available nationally or?
I think it's somewhat limited.
Okay.
There's certainly a lot of excellent urology nurses doing it in different institutions, probably mainly in the cancer centres.
Yeah.
I suppose I chose to separate it out of a regular clinic.
Yes.
Because I felt that it was a topic that was taking, that would take, in a regular clinic, somebody is queuing up and really they're focused on a PSA and, you know, and urinary or bowel symptoms.
Yeah.
I work in radiotherapy. So, and then, you know, if they don't really want to be bringing up, God, I can't have intercourse or this is not working, because it's not a one line conversation.
Of course, it's opening that conversation.
It's opening that conversation. So we would address, we use assessment tools. So we would address that at their outpatient clinic as urology with post-surgery. And if they have if they bring it up that it is a concern to them, because again, it's important to acknowledge that just because it's talked about now, it may not be a concern to you. And if it's not, that's fine too.
Yeah.
That if it's a concern to him, that there's some place to go. And when they come on the one day a week, hopefully it will increase, and it does need to increase to more than one day a week.
Yeah.
If they're coming just that topic is equally as important as your urinary symptoms, your bowel symptoms, or your PSA to you, that it's to try and make it an important topic.
Yeah. So it's very much, you know, it comes across to me as being a holistic approach to care, which I really like to hear.
Exactly. Yeah. Hopefully.
Yeah. So, you know, clinically, you know, seeing the surgeon or the radiotherapist is different to seeing somebody like the clinical nurse specialist or yourself who's kind of subspecialized in an area. And I think that's a huge credit, you know, to a urology department anywhere in the country.
When we started this journey, I had excellent support from my urology consultant colleagues, and they trained me in the process of doing the injection therapy. And and I think everybody felt there was a need when it kind of came up in conversation. I suppose I had a particular interest.
And Jer, just on another note, I suppose, you know, there may well be people who attend your clinic and they're not doing so well psychologically because of, you know, these unwanted effects, and maybe that things aren't, you know, their expectations aren't being met. Do you have a referral process to, say, for instance, psychosexual counselling? Or
unfortunately, I'm not a psychosexual counsellor, and I do acknowledge that with men and their partners early on in the time, that is not. We have very limited psychosexual counsellors in Ireland.
Yeah.
We did have a lady in Galway, but she's subsequently retired. So we have very limited psychosexual counselling. I do refer them to support centres like yourselves, because there is psychological support there, but it is definitely a need. Now, when men come initially, over time, they will acknowledge that there is a whole holistic. Sometimes when I meet men initially, it's like, well, I can't do it. So it's not in my head.
Yeah.
So we do have to get around that a little
bit. It takes time.
It takes time, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, understandably. But it is nice to know also that there is somewhere else for them to go, you know, where, you know, expectations aren't met and there are interventions. And sometimes men can be quite practical in that sense that if interventions aren't met, what next, you know?
Absolutely. And I would acknowledge the support centres at the outset that, you know, while I can do so much that I sometimes the holistic approach in that a psychologist may be if we could do the two together. So, again, we kind of let the person dictate as to where they, so they're given the numbers and then they let them dictate it as to whether they want to contact the service or not.
Yeah. And thanks for bringing that up, Ger. I think it's really important for our listeners to know that anywhere in the country, there are local cancer support centres offering lots of, you know, psychological support, but also lots of complementary therapies that actually can help people to relax a little bit, you know, and find time and space to actually talk through their problems too. So there's only one Ger in Galway. but it is important for you know, families and men and men, anyone born with a prostate, to actually, you know, seek that support and help, because they're wonderful places. And there a lot of them are purpose built these days with lots of supportive care. So that's what I would say on that front.
A lot of them sometimes have like gym facilities or a physio that will go through an exercise program, because I think it is important, and this is all encompassed within sexual dysfunction. Men that are on androgen deprivation therapy, their bodies can change, you can be more prone to putting on a little bit of weight. So to feel good about yourself, to try and encourage diet and exercise, and we do that, but there is specialists in these centres that can help.
No, it's great, and we work quite closely with a lot of the cancer support centres in Ireland too. Ger, you mentioned about physiotherapy there, in, I suppose, in relation to exercise, but you or I know, are not experts in the whole kind of continence space, but I would like to maybe acknowledge one of our specialist physiotherapists.
Brilliant.
Who actually worked in Beaumont, and she's actually provided me with a lot of literature, but equally, I would have worked in the space myself. And I think it's important to actually, you know, bring up the incontinence and talk a little bit about, you know, I suppose, the effects of that. And the biggest motivator to manage incontinence is to be incontinent.
Exactly.
You know, and I suppose there's about 60% of men who are incontinent, maybe mostly post-surgery as opposed to radiotherapy. But it's really important that we say that out loud, and that conversation begins to happen for men, that they seek help and they're not trying to deal with this alone. I think that's really, really important. And, you know, it does recover mostly over time. And some, you know, some men would talk about, I suppose, that incontinence being an absolute, you know, change in their lives, in the worst possible way they could imagine. And Paul mentioned that. John has also mentioned that, you know, in his episode. So it's really important that we acknowledge that cancer control is probably the most important motivating factor here for to have treatments in the first place. But also to acknowledge that, you know, if you were to, I suppose, put urinary incontinence on the table and erectile dysfunction, urinary incontinence is often quite difficult for men, really difficult for men to deal with.
Absolutely.
And then erectile dysfunction, you know.
Yeah, and I think a lot of men prioritise their urinary incontinence, which is the right thing. They would prioritise that first. I think it's also important to acknowledge the pelvic floor exercise to continue them, because sometimes when the urinary incontinence is improved and one is back living, that pelvic floor exercise also help their erectile function, and they can help with control if they do get an erection with an intervention, because sometimes you can have a little bit of a leak at that point in time. Now, obviously, in a clinic, we'll go through that in depth, but just as I say to men, pelvic floor exercises are present for life.
For men and women.
For men and women and anyone over a certain age.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So, I mean, it's like, I suppose saying that if I even maybe like, you know, it happens mostly in men who've had a prostatectomy or their prostate removed, because the internal sphincter is removed during surgery. And that's a very simple explanation. And I hope that most men are told that so that they kind of understand that the possibilities are quite high. You know, and again, I think in the initial stages, I'd certainly remember in my practice that it can be torrential and it's kind of devastating, because there is an uncertainty as to whether the, whether that that level of incontinence is going to recover or not. But we do know that over time and within a year, most men are dry, you know, and maybe not wearing pads at all, or maybe wearing a pad for comfort during the day. But they may be still suffering with long-term what we call stress incontinence, where there's a leak on coughing, sneezing, maybe having, you know, sexual intercourse. And it's just knowing that and being prepared for that is really important too. So I suppose it's really important, you know, for men to ask for help. Most hospitals have physiotherapists now that will actually help in this regard and teach men how to do pelvic floor exercises, actually to identify them in the first place. That's really important. And then to teach them the regimes of, you know, strengthening the pelvic floor, but endurance as well, and actually managing that little bit of stress incontinence that might come about. And the other thing I'd like to say there, there are lots of products on the market now. There's from the HSE. But there are lots of pads, you know, available. And again, I think we need to mention here that men are not used to wearing pads. Women are.
Exactly.
And it's a really important factor too. So it's quite devastating to have to wear pads. But actually, with the right kind of help and assistance and the right kind of continence wear, men will generally overcome that.
Absolutely. And I know certainly in, from being to the meeting urology nurses within the conferences, even with Zoom and stuff, there's fantastic things available now. And your urology nurse is a great source of information. Even just tips on cutting back tea, coffee, those kind of things if you're going travelling or all of those little things. Your urology nurse can often come up with a lot of tips that you just, common sense things that you mightn't think about.
Yeah. So what would we say to men? Like, we're in the survivorship space here now, Ger, where, you know, we're helping to improve their lives because we're actually helping them to manage their erectile dysfunction, their urinary incontinence. We run a program ourselves called Survive and Thrive. It's a 6-week program for men and women. And it helps, you know, people to live. You know, they've come out the other side, but it helps them to live in the new world that they live in with, you know, with having had cancer, I suppose. And within that, you know, we the first thing, probably one of the first things we talked about today was cancer control. It's top of the list. But also with that comes, you know, dealing with the uncertainty and that PSA, you know, will it remain the same or will it rise? And I sometimes say PSA stands for promoting stress and anxiety. Once you've had a test, you're always waiting for the answer. But what would your take-home message be, Ger, to any man or family that you would see?
I suppose my take-home, and I meet people at the beginning of their treatment within radiotherapy and with erectile dysfunction, is ask any question. Don't be afraid to ask anything. We have heard it before, most likely. And if we don't know the answer, I certainly will put my hand up to somebody and say, I don't know the answer, but I will find out for you. To always ask the question, life is for living and there does become a new normal, but it can be a good normal. It can be, you know, getting a diagnosis is not nice for anybody, but it can help you prioritize your life a little bit and look at life a little differently in a positive way.
Talking.
And talking. I think talking is the key. Anything else we can sort out. At some, it may not be what you thought initially when we start off the journey, but talking is open the conversation and talking. And we are more delighted working within the area if somebody asks the question in case we've forgotten to ask something. Or I'm much happier if somebody brings something up with me because I might just have forgotten to ask on that day. Or so always bring up anything that's concerning them.
Ask any questions you want.
Any questions. And honestly, people... most healthcare professionals prefer if people ask the questions. If you're going in and you're afraid you'll forget to ask the questions, write it down. Bring in the list. In fact, I am I always love when someone takes out their little list of questions and then they usually say at the end, well, I don't need to ask, you've answered all of these, and they tick them off. But that's great because then they're going out the door feeling. And most men will have a direct contact details to a urology nurse, advanced practice. You know, ring them if you need anything.
No, that's great. Great advice. And one thing I'd like to say within the Marie Keating Foundation, I did talk about Survive and Thrive, the 6-week program. So if anybody wants to join that program, just go to our website, mariekeating.ie. And if you go to the events page, and that's for anybody who's had cancer, come out the other side, and you know, are living their lives. And we want to help in that regard. We want to help people manage themselves into their new normal.
Absolutely. And yeah. I certainly have had men and partners that have done these courses and have found them really helpful.
Great.
And has changed their lives in the most positive ways.
Yeah. And they meet people, you know, who empower them because they're going through similar things. And the other program I really like to mention here today is our Positive Living program. And that's for men with metastatic cancers. John Wall is a member of that group. And again, quite a difficult space to be. But the power of coming together for men and women, but like it's harder to get men together. I think we have to acknowledge that. But the power of bringing men together who have a metastatic cancer of any kind is actually, you know, it's so enlightening because they do talk, give them a safe place, and you do talk. And I suppose Blue September is our, you know, Prostate Cancer Awareness Month. And we do have, what I really love is we have a blue pin now. It's like a little man. And if men wear that pin, or women either, it'll create a conversation because it'll open up a conversation quite simply by asking, what's that? You know, and then you say, well, this is like I'm standing up for my prostate. And that's what it means. So it opens up a conversation very naturally. I'd love to see the blue pin as representative as the pink ribbon.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it would be fantastic.
Yeah.
And I suppose, you know, just because you're wearing a blue pin doesn't mean you have to tell anyone your story, but it's just identifying that there is a story in quite a lot of Irish men.
Yeah. Yeah. So on that note, Gerard, I'd like to thank you so much for being with us today. We wish all our listeners a very happy Blue September. And know that the survival rates of prostate cancer are scoring high at 94%. So, you know, get in there early, get yourself checked. Prostate cancer doesn't always have symptoms, and we acknowledge that. But, you know, when you reach a certain age, or you, i.e. 50, or you have a family member with prostate cancer, do have that conversation with your GP. Early detection saves lives, and that's what we're here for. Thank you.
Thank you.
I would like to acknowledge Wemi Chokra, who is a pelvic physiotherapist and has provided information and literature on managing incontinence and has certainly supported us in this episode.
That's all for this season of the Marie Keating Foundation Talks Cancer podcast. A huge thank you to all of our incredible guests this season for their time, expertise and commitment. A special thank you to those sharing their cancer journey with such dignity. Your stories are so powerful and inspiring. We'd also like to thank our sponsors, Janssen, for making this podcast series possible. Our final thank you goes out to all of you, our audience, for listening, sharing and supporting prostate cancer awareness. Visit mariekeating.ie for the most up-to-date information about prostate cancer and for more on our most recent campaign, Stand Up For Your Prostate. Until next time, stay safe and well.